face with everybody, the transportation industry, the banking industry. Everybody's trying to define their own standard, and the problem is you've got tremendous overlap. I guarantee you every one of these has to deal with address. As an example, you'd think address would be something that you could establish a global standard for. Well, the problem is even address is a very, very, very complex concept. And you've got international flavors of address, you've got, you know, regional flavors of address. So it becomes very challenging. So tackling this problem, not only Lockheed Martin, but the aerospace industry said we need to drive toward some common XML schema requirement. And you're going to see on these next two slides, or the next few slides here, three basic breakdowns of those schema requirements. You've got the foundational or structure. So things like XML and XML schema from W3C, those are absolutely foundational standards. Along with that, a global naming convention standard, 11179, which is international, and that is a key standard. And then the United Nations XML schema naming and design rules, which are part of the EBXML world. And then you've got this thing called the payload, or payload requirements. There's a whole host of standards out there. You know, the people in the, and I've got a slide that will talk about it shortly, but in the payload world, you've got the RosettaNet world, which primarily is electronics world. You've got the XBRL, which is the world's leading accounting firms. And you've got a whole host of other flavors of XML. UBL is trying to make get a start there too. But I say the most important foundational piece for the payload is to establish a common set of basic data types. What is a text? What is an amount? What is a quantity? There's two gold nuggets in the the ISO 15000-5, which is the core components technical spec. There's two gold nuggets in that thing, namely the basic data type, amount, date, name, quantity, in tables 8-1 and 8-3. Those are fundamental gold nuggets in the payload. If you don't establish common understanding of these gold nuggets, I guarantee you interoperability will never, never happen.
Ron,
yes.
As you switch slides, it would be good for people on the phone.
I'm sorry.
Give some indication.
I'm sorry. Good point. I just switched to the example payload standard slide. And so now these are examples of payload standards that are out there. You could throw UBL onto this list. You could put RosettaNet on the list. There's some areas that are more, you might say, redundant with each other. I put the wage is more redundant with RosettaNet and UBL. But the healthcare world, all of your healthcare providers have an HL7. The insurance industry has Accord, and these are, you know, global insurance providers. Your global accounting firms have XBRL. And then in the world that I come from, where configuration management, as you're in an engineering design process and building and designing products and manufacturing those products and need to manage configuration control of the changes of those products, the EIA 36 has an XML DTD, which is moving into a schema. So things like engineering changes. And then there's this additional layer after you get the foundational structure and then the payload. Then there's another layer called your infrastructure support. And for that, there's a need for a centralized registry repository so that across an entire industry, go to a single place, find out what the standard is for that industry. And then because there is no single XML schema that's globally adopted by everybody on the planet, whether you're government or industry or nonprofit, until that point in time, you need something that can transcend all of those different organizations. And that's what the intent of the UDF is. It basically helps provide an indexing mechanism that identifies the points of intersection across these various schema, as well as to improve data understandability. So what is this thing called the UDF, or Universal Data Framework? It's basically an instantiation of this 11179-5 standard. And if you look at that standard, all it really tells you to do is you must have object classes and you must have property terms for a given data element concept. It defines what a data element concept is. You have to have something called a property term combined with something called an object class. And it does not specify what those property terms should be, nor does it specify what the object terms should be. So this organization that I was the chair of back in the CALS Industry Steering Group days, it was an organization of industry working with government, primarily DOD. We developed this UDF concept. We adopted the 11179 naming convention. And UDF is basically an instantiation of that standard. It also, by the way, adopted out of the core components technical spec the same term, basic data types, if you will, that come directly out of EBXML's core components. So these are your fundamental data types, amount, date, time, identifier, and so forth. These are the foundation building blocks that will never achieve interoperability if the entire planet doesn't adopt these. And then, if you look at a taxonomy or ontology of basic objects applicable to any enterprise on the planet, what are those basic objects? And that's what the UDF object list is intended to be. When you understand the definitions in UDF, they are mutually exclusive. And so you have any enterprise on the planet, there's data about the enterprise. Any enterprise on the planet, there's data about their product, even if you're a service organization. A service is simply a subtype of product. You have assets, you have persons. UDF naming convention then also takes advantage of qualifiers. So against this list, you've got an ontology, if you will, of all of these basic properties and then subtypes of those properties. For instance, a date could have a delivery date, and it could be a scheduled delivery date. That's a subtype of date. And so there's an ontology of all kinds of different types of dates. But standing alone, that date doesn't mean anything until you associate it with an object. And so you then, because UDF basically enforces a rule that the order of the words must be according to this 11179, and then following the rules of English, a given word that's added to a string must precede, when it's a qualifier, must precede the word that's modified. So that when you end up with a UDF name that follows those rules, you have something that's grammatically correct. It follows the rules of English. And so an engineering design process cost amount, you must use one of these words and you must use one of those words. And then you end up with something that's grammatically correct. And when you enforce the rules of UDF, you'll end up with something that technically would not even require a definition, because it should be intuitively obvious to anybody that's working in that domain.
Okay.
So if you take those different standards and put together an architecture or a standard stack, you got these basic schema structure standards as listed here, XML, XML schema from W3C, 11179-5, EBXML core components technical spec, UN naming and design rules. And then you got in this middle layer all of these various flavors of XML schema along with each industry has to either take a subset of those schema or extend them. In the case of X-12, for instance, our aerospace industry said, we've got an implementation convention of X-12, and it's a subset. We don't need the entire X-12 for a purchase order. We'd say we've got a subset. But in the case of for instance, OAGIS, OAGIS is one of those 70% or 80%. It's not sufficient for our industry, so we have to extend it. So there's going to be organization-specific extensions or subsets of these standards. And then on top of that, you've got RDF and OWL, and those help do metadata alignment between different ontologies. But when you get to the semantics of the payload, that's where the UDF comes in. I indicated that those basic data types were matched up directly with EBXML core components. The words in yellow on the left are directly out of EBXML core components technical spec table 8-3, and the words in green then are the UDEF names, and you can see it's going through that list that they're one and the same. These are the basic objects in UDEF, and these give context to a given property string, like scheduled delivery date. It could be a product scheduled delivery date. It could be a document scheduled delivery date. It could be a baby's scheduled delivery date. So you have to put an object into these things before you can know what those, you know, basic building blocks of properties are relating to. So these UDEF objects are, you take things like a purchase order. A purchase order is a document. Well, if you want to force a computer to understand that a purchase order is a document, and then put document in the name, then you're forcing all documents to use the word document in the name. So purchase order document. Yeah, we need you closer to the door. Okay. You need to put the word purchase order or the word document into a purchase order document's name. And that way you've got, within the UDEF, you're forcing everything to the same level of abstraction, which then forces you to use words, or you end up with a UDEF name that's substantially longer than the normal in most systems. You're not forcing anybody to use the UDEF name. The key to the UDEF, though, is basically to come up with the ID, the Dewey Decimal Number, if you will, that has structure and intelligence within that ID. And so if you go to the slide on UDEF ontologies, there are, in fact, 16 of those UDEF objects. Each of them has its own ontology, which is a subtyping of all of those objects. So what's shown here in the example is that there is an object called document, and a subtype of document is an order document. And a subtype of order document could be a work order, a change order, a technical order, or a purchase order. And there are others, by the way. So the UDEF has an ontology of subtyping of each of the 16 objects. It also has an ontology of subtyping of each of the 18 property words that come from EBXML core components technical spec. And so when you end up using this approach and then assigning an indexing ID, if you will, this D.T.2_33.4 is the same as purchase order document type code. And no matter what language you want to have, if that concept exists in Korean or Japanese or Spanish or whatever, Russian, whatever that concept is, independently, organizations would map to the UDEF and assign that concept, this ID. That ID then is computer sensible. The computer knows how to interpret that, and basically it becomes your canonical model for any kind of business transaction or even in our industry, getting the things like war fighters putting weapons on targets with a certain timing. So these UDEF structured IDs are the key. Here you've got two different product data management systems, PDM system A and B. You've got six different standards. The concept is that I've got this thing called a product ID, but with the UDEF I can also add the fact that it's the manufacturer's assigned ID as opposed to the retailer's assigned ID, as opposed to someone else's assigned ID. You can capture that additional metadata if you choose with the UDEF. And so, in essence, you get the 2N instead of the N squared problem. Here's an example, then, of applying the UDEF with XML. Taking two instances, one from XCDO, which two from two different industries, one XCBO, which is used in our industry by ExoStar, which is a host that manages a lot of our transactions. By taking those data elements and assigning a UDEF ID, and then doing similarly to OAGIS 7.2, and then because they share now common IDs but have independently been mapped, and those IDs could be made available in an API to both systems, and then sending those these two files that have these IDs added and sending them to that URL that's listed at the bottom of the slide, you can in fact have a gap analysis report sent back to you in less than a second. And so if when two different trading partners are trying to figure out where do we have semantic alignment between what one company uses versus another company, and this is realistic, our industry uses a lot of XCDL. A lot of other industries, you know, the automotive and many others use OAGIS. Others use a RosettaNet. If they independently map their elements like this for a typical purchase order and give UDEF IDs, then the semantics of alignment can be done almost immediately by going to that URL. It'll spit back a gap analysis report, similar to this. Basically, two different systems independently map their elements, assign those IDs, and then the report that comes back basically says, for this on one system has this ID, that's what it is in the other system. And so that's there. Although it's not, you know, that URL is not a what I call an industrial strength capability, because it was demonstrated for a proof of concept at EIDX meetings in May of 2003, as well as August 2003. So to actually implement the UDEF basically requires a global UDEF registry. The aerospace industry is working with the Association for Enterprise Integration, which is under the National Defense Industrial Association. NDIA, working with AIA, aerospace industry, that's the Boeing's, Lockheed's, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman. We're trying to define a global nonprofit to actually manage the UDEF tree structures. I've got, at the end of conclusion here, I'll briefly show, unfortunately the folks on the phone won't be able to see it, but briefly show examples of the tree structures for several of those different taxonomies. But basically, to host them that and manage the extensions, additional extensions to the UDEF. Within a given enterprise, and Lockheed Martin or the Department of Defense or whomever, that have lots and lots of back office systems. We heard, for instance, the logistics folks in DOD have some 700 back office systems that they currently have to deal with. They need something to help them manage their metadata. And so you've got lots and lots of different schemas there. You've got lots and lots of, you know, you have the need for a mapping matrix. And basically some mapping, you know, some centralized registry that was totally keyed on UDEF IDs and then matrices like what the XREF is. So here's what it is in this system, here's what it is in this system, here's what it is in this standard, and this standard, and this standard, and oh, by the way, it's keyed by a UDEF ID. That UDEF ID then gets exposed in an API so that when you want to integrate two systems that all have this UDEF ID in the API, you now take advantage of this online UDEF gap analysis report. Okay, you heard earlier about RFID, or several of you did. In that session, you also heard about the, you know, the DoD's unique ID. I'm going to use this simply as an example of how the UDEF can be applied to DoD's unique ID requirement. Basically, DoD has this requirement. You have a globally unique ID that is comprised of three elements. It requires the enterprise ID, the part number, and the serial number, and that string of three elements are concatenated into a single field called unique ID. And this slide on the UID and the supply chain summarizes how that's going to work. It says that at the system level, in other words, this example is a G, at the system level, you got a system unique ID. The various sub-assemblies within that also have their unique IDs, even down to the parts, you know, the component parts like a bolt. And so each of those then has to feed into the total system, but each of them has their unique IDs. If you apply the UDEF, you can now bring additional metadata to it. Currently, the DoD is only asking for enterprise ID. But if they want to differentiate, well, it's the manufacturer's enterprise ID, and, oh, by the way, it's the one that was assigned by DUNS, as opposed to the one assigned by the Defense Logistics Agency. You heard about the CAGE code. As opposed to the one assigned by EAN-UCC, which is the retail industry, then you can add that additional metadata in there by what the UDEF offers, or you can also just say it enterprise ID. So the UDEF brings to the table the opportunity to add additional metadata if you choose. And with it, if you choose the additional metadata, then you also get the ID that goes with that. So, for instance, the top example here shows manufacturer enterprise DUNS assigned identifier AH.3_5.35.8. Only one person in a given business ever has to deal with that number, and that's the person that does the initial mapping. After that, it's the computers that then take advantage of those IDs, which are like IP addresses. Computers know how to deal with number dot number dot number. That's what your internet IP address is, number dot number dot number. Computers know how to deal with that quite rapidly. It also allows you the ability to allow you to know that it's a weapon system as opposed to a part. So that additional metadata is something that you can bring to the table. But if you don't want it, that's fine. It's just a part ID or a part ID, you know, product ID, product ID. So the flexibility is there to bring additional metadata and the associated UDEF IDs. And this is something that is, you know, gaining some attention within the Department of Defense. I worked with, representing Lockheed Martin, with Raytheon and Northrop Grumman, and we actually did a mapping against five different DoD documents. The different DoD documents were an actual procurement of a Raytheon spare part, happened to be a cable harness. But we analyzed all of the fields in those five procurement documents against, in other words, the request for quote, the response to the request for quote, the purchase order, the DD-250, which is your receiving an inspection report, and the invoice. And it's within the DD-250 where those UID requirements are going to be required, in other words, the unique ID. So we mapped them all against that, and basically we've got a a large, large spreadsheet that captures that. And this is only a snippet of it. But when you look at comparing the UDEF names versus the system names, now we're in that DoD document, you've got this thing called DPAS priority. And if you map it into OAGIS XML with this XML path name, it's a purchase order header priority. But if you assign it the UDEF name, it comes out to purchase order document government assigned priority curve, which is a much more descriptive name of what that is compared to DPAS priority or what this is. And the bottom line is, it makes it much more understandable to somebody that doesn't know what a DPAS priority is. The reason I use this example, if you take the UDEF approach, which forces you into common levels of abstraction, you end up with names that are much longer than you'd normally use. DPAS priority is a whole lot smaller name than purchase order document government signed priority code. But I can give that to someone who's never seen a DPAS priority before, and they can begin to get an understanding of what that is. And you don't need to have that subject matter expert around who understands that system if they've done this once, and not let a computer say that d.t.2_1.4.31.4 is equal to the name. You can now let, you know, other people potentially get involved in building or modifying a system or using a system. And so for understandability, UDEF forces you into a 11179 naming approach. It forces you into a common level of abstraction based on these high-level objects as well as that set of EBXML core component terms. Recently, the UDEF has shown up in the press in the fact that Network World, one of their editors or a consultant and columnist, a guy named Mark Gibbs, he wrote an article, and I take this quote directly out of that article, and you can go to the website and read the whole article. The need for UDEF is massive and inescapable, and the bigger the enterprise, the greater the need. And basically what he's saying is, because bigger enterprises have a whole lot of back office systems they have to tie together, and because they have typically a much, much larger supply chain that they have to deal with, the bigger the enterprise, the greater the need for UDEF. Our industry has a set of standards that we're looking at, and I want to put UDEF into a proper context. Because we don't have the global registry stood up yet, we can't put it into the adopted category, but our industry is definitely considering it a candidate along with these standards that are showing up here. And this set of standards, then, we're either monitoring, exploring use, or participating directly in the development. UDEF is one of the categories for the direct participation. I'll show this slide again tomorrow when I talk about what our industry is doing with the standards. If you want additional information on 11179, you can download it from that site there. If you want to see an article how the UDEF directly relates to the EBXML core components, you can go online and read that article. And if you want to get more information about the UDEF in depth, you can go to udef.org, or you can give me a call or send me an email. And that concludes my presentation.